You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led, independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled Awareness Advances Action, Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Generalized Myasthenia Gravis. It is intended for healthcare professionals and is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany, and UCB, Inc.
Hello, my name is Kelly Guathme. I'm a neuromuscular neurologist at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And it is an honor to be with you today to discuss this third episode, Advances in GMG Implications for Practice. With me, I have Dr. Sitara Ramdas. Dr. Ramdas is a consultant pediatric neurologist at Oxford Children's Hospital in the UK. Welcome, Sitara.
Thank you, Kelly.
So I'm excited to be here talking about advances in GMG implications for practice. This is part of a larger independent medical program on myasthenia gravis. And then right now we'll be focusing on how to assess and introduce these newer therapies into practice. And so right now, going over the adult just briefly to discuss our current therapeutic landscape on the adult side, we have, of course, the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors such as prednisone. We have corticosteroids. These two medications have been the backbone of how we treated myasthenia gravis for many decades. We also use quite commonly nonsteroidal immunosuppressive therapies such as azathioprine or mycophenolate mofetil, occasionally methotrexate, cyclosporin, tacrolimus. And then for our patients who are having an exacerbation or crisis in the hospital, we will use IVIG, plasma exchange. And then we have this entire new chapter of these novel therapeutics, including neonatal Fc receptor antagonists and also complement inhibitors, with newer treatments coming at us very quickly, right, that are B and T cell targeted therapies, including cladribine, which is in a phase 3 trial. It's an oral agent that targets both B and T cells. And then we have rituximab, which is targets B cells. It's been around for a long time. Inebilizumab, that data was just published for the phase 3 trial. And so it's a very, very exciting time. And so I think it's important for us to really think about why these new therapeutic advances are needed. There's such an unmet need. There's a lot of burden of disease still for our patients. And so from your perspective, can you speak to how we think that these advances are going to be changing the management of our patients with myasthenia gravis?
So Kelly, when we think from a pediatric point of view, obviously myasthenia gravis is rare in pediatric age group, but it is a significant disease which has a significant burden, like in the adult population, in our children and young people. I think, as you say, you know, we've had steroids and prednisone as the backbone for decades, but actually steroids in particular has significant side effects, which has implication in children and young people who might need to take immunosuppression, who will need to take it for decades, I think. So there is a cumulative side effect that needs to be considered. So the newer treatments will really help curtail those side effects that we have with the current treatments. And also with the current treatments, actually in the pediatric age group, we really don't have any strong randomized clinical trials or anything that's ever happened. So our evidence of use is really based on adult study, and we extrapolate it because the pathophysiology is same. So it's really exciting that we now have pediatric trials specifically for these new treatments. And also some pediatric trials have already shown positive results similar to adults. So, you know, we hope the other trials will also show similar, both efficacy, but also good safety data, which is really important when you're treating, you know, young people who might need treatment for long. And, you know, just because a child is not the same as a young adult. So there's different, you know, pharmaco and kinetics and dynamics that need to be considered. So I do think our treatment pathways will change over coming times. I think how we rescue our treatment, our patients, how we start treatment even at the disease onset will really change. Particularly, I think for generalized MG, I think ocular MG probably, at least in the initial onset, which is quite important in the pediatric age group, as it's much more common, would still probably be prednisone and steroids. but we might escalate to the newer treatments much more quicker rather than going with our traditional azathioprine MMF.
Right. Thank you for that perspective. I'll say on the adult side, it's been really exciting to see how we can individualize these different treatment pathways for our patients. So for example, since we right now have so many different tools in our toolkit, you know, I can say that some patients just respond more to complement inhibition, where some patients just respond beautifully to neonatal Fc receptor inhibition, right? So we get to sort of select an agent and go with it and see if that's working and then pivot to a different drug class if we need to. And so it's really been the first time in myasthenia that we've ever been able to do that and really innovate and tailor these different treatments for these patients. And I'd also like to say it's nice too, because these different treatments are coming to market. They have not only different mechanisms of action, of course, but they have different routes of administration and frequency of administration. And so we can give one patient an infusion every 8 weeks, whereas a different patient might prefer to have a self-injection daily. And then we can also factor in the side effect profile, right, of course. And so there is a very robust conversation with our patients when we diagnose them, and then also as their disease evolves over time, about really what their treatment preferences are. And we try to accommodate to the best of our ability, you know, in 2025. And so it's a really, really exciting time. And so I was just curious, from your perspective with the pediatric population, how do you have these conversations about, you know, balancing efficacy, safety, and patient preference when you're selecting a therapeutic?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost is discussing, you know, I think going back to the mechanism of action of the drugs, that's important for the families to realize, you know, why can you just not stay on acetylcholine receptor inhibitors, why the immunosuppression is needed. And then looking at, you know, each patient characteristics as to, you know, how would they tolerate steroids, okay, or is this someone who already has other health problems, you know, overweight, obesity, you know, other things that actually steroids might not be suitable for them. Thinking particularly in our young girls who are very pubertal and post-pubertal about treatment immunosuppression, particularly mycophenolate mofetil, which is teratogenic, as they're going into adult life, they will need this ongoing immunosuppression. So to avoid those drugs, which they need to change in the future when they're considering a family, are important implications to have very early on, even when they might be 13, when you have that discussion, because, you know, they will need the treatment for decades. I think with the newer treatment, the way I approach it with our families is we've got, you know, it's again the benefit that we have from the clinical trials, you know, the efficacy, but also the safety profiles, which are slightly different, and comparing that with our current treatments that we have, which have, you know, longer data of safety and efficacy, but actually the mechanism of action are different. And with the newer treatment, we see that FX coming in much more quicker, and why that might be an advantage, particularly when the disease, you know, you want to get it under control quicker, as quickly as possible. So I think those can be helpful. And obviously, families and patients have different opinions and choices on what suits best for them. And that always comes into the finalizing, you know, what treatment they're going to start on.
And thank you for that. And also, you made this point during an earlier podcast. I think it's so important that if a patient is not responding to treatment, if a child is not, then the index of suspicion that could potentially be congenital myasthenic syndrome must be there, right? And you even made the point that consider testing them for congenital myasthenic syndrome before starting any immunosuppressant therapy. And so I think we just really need to emphasize that for our listeners too.
Yeah, I think particularly in the pediatric age group where we have high rates of seronegativity, neurophysiology might be negative, you know, considering congenital myasthenia syndrome panel testing, which is now widely available, should be undertaken before, yeah, long-term immunosuppression is initiated.
And for you, is your treatment approach for the seronegative patients any different than the seropositive patients?
No, it would be similar to the seropositive patients, the treatment approaches. But yeah, it's just a diagnostic. You would just, yeah, make sure you've covered all the bases from a diagnostic point of view.
Right. And on the adult side, where we do have some of these newer therapeutics more readily available, you know, at this time, they are not labeled. The complement inhibitors and the neonatal Fc receptor antagonists are not labeled for seronegative myasthenia gravis. Of course, you know, there's some trials ongoing to answer that question, but that is a time where we're a little bit more limited in what we can do. And that's when we rely on sometimes IVIG, corticosteroids, nonsteroidal immunosuppressant therapies, and so on, and the seronegative population. And so it can be very frustrating on the adult side if you have seronegative and every advertisement on TV is only for seropositive patients. So, and so also I wanted to just touch on a little bit therapeutic approach in women of reproductive age. I mean, you already pointed this out. And so that is absolutely always a discussion and consideration. You pointed out mycophenolate mofetil is not something that we would use in someone who is planning to become pregnant or pregnant. From my perspective, we do feel like azathioprine is relatively safe during pregnancy. And so certainly there have been a number of patients I've supported through pregnancy on azathioprine. We do also have some kind of earlier data that eculizumab is likely safe in pregnancy. And so we do support patients with that. If necessary, you know, chronic IVIG during pregnancy, we will use. And then, of course, prednisone always, you know, is kind of the first thing we go to, right? And if we can get away with just using that, that's ideal. Occasionally a low dose corticosteroid if necessary. Just curious what your thoughts are about that and what your approach would be.
So I would start by saying, fortunately, I don't have many patients who do get pregnant during when they are under my care. But I think these approaches would be what, when I've had discussion with my adult colleagues, but this would be similar. But what I do have are mothers who have babies who can be affected because of the myasthenia gravis in the mother. And we've got two particular conditions. One is the transient neonatal myasthenia gravis, which is babies, you know, born soon after birth, feeding difficulties, floppiness because of the maternal antibodies. And as the antibodies settle, babies improve. But what's more, which is rarer than the transient neonatal myasthenia, is this condition called fetal acetylcholine receptor antibody associated disease, where you get a very early onset myopathy, including arthrogryposis multiplex from antibodies, which is against the fetal subunit of the acetylcholine receptor antibody. So, and that is particularly important because many of these mothers may be completely asymptomatic about, you know, and also actually controlling the mother's myasthenia, reducing the antibody levels, has a positive impact on the fetal outcome. So actually working together with the adult neurologist to managing the pregnancy is really important in this situation. And that's when, you know, I would really be involved with a pregnant mom with myasthenia gravis, because to improve the outcome in the baby.
Okay, that's an extremely important point too. So thank you for raising that. And I'll say too, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, how do we manage our elderly population? And I would argue, you know, it's very similar to how we manage our middle-aged population with a few exceptions. You know, first and foremost, thymectomy. So we don't tend to offer thymectomy to non-thymomatous seropositive myasthenia gravis in patients over the age of 50 unless they have refractory disease. And so that's not something that we commonly recommend and discuss. Also, because our older population tends to have more medical comorbidities, we see a lot more issues, I think, with corticosteroid use, right? So our older population often is diabetic, or sometimes they're overweight, or they have, you know, cataracts already, for example. And so we just have to be really careful with the therapies that we choose in terms of the side effect profile. And corticosteroids, again, comes to mind first and foremost. And, you know, thinking about all of these different options that, again, are landing in our lap on the adult side and coming to you on the pediatric side, I was just curious if you have any thoughts about why there continues to be some prescribing hesitancy or treatment inertia in the community with these newer therapeutics. And I know in your world, eculizumab is available, you know, and nipocalimab, hopefully in the future for your patients. But any thoughts on that?
What I find first and foremost is how neurologists treat myasthenia gravis. They treat it a bit like neuroinflammatory disorders of the brain. So, you know, give something, get better, it's gone away. So, and I think that's where the approach really needs to change, to say, why do we need these newer treatments? You know, actually, this has a huge impact. Yes, a patient comes, walks into your clinic, is going to school, doing the things, but actually they are not able to do the the things that they really want to do. So myasthenia is really a significant illness that you need to get under control quicker. So I think once we get that message out to say that actually newer treatments work quicker, you can get the disease under control quicker, then I think people will start using them more and more. And also it's getting comfortable with these treatments. So, you know, levels of immunosuppression with eculizumab or the newer complement inhibitors are not something that is routinely used in neurology practice. It's immune treatment. So there's always a bit of hesitancy, I think, with new things when they come to say, is it really the ones? Why should we change what we do always? But I think we can change that with more and more, hopefully, education like this. Actually, there is a difference with the newer treatments. They work quicker. You can get your patients under control with disease quicker. We've got, you know, relatively good safety data that, you know, and they can be monitored with the, you know, a clear monitoring that is required. So I think that's how the practice is going to change. And I hope, and I think it will, that the hesitancy for starting the treatments will get less and less over time as it's used more widely.
Right. You raise great points, and I agree with you. I think as a person who takes care of myasthenia gravis all day, every day, you know, the number of new therapeutics could be overwhelming even for me, right? Every time I refresh my home screen, there's another drug that's been approved or another paper published. And so it's an extremely exciting time in myasthenia therapeutics. But, you know, I just envision the provider out in the community who might only have that one MG patient. And so it must be a little bit overwhelming to understand all these different new therapies, what their side effect profile is, lab monitoring, and so on, when you don't do this day in and day out. And that's why I agree with you. These educational opportunities, such as this podcast series, is so important for the community and really to elevate the importance of thinking about these new drugs and how quickly they work. And as you said, the favorable side effect profile and our general just intolerance of under-treatment these days, right? We always want to be thinking about how we can do a better job and potentially get our patients into minimal manifestation status or minimal symptom expression, which, you know, is an MG-ADL of 0 or 1 point. So really, that's becoming the treatment goal. And the fact that we can even say that is really exciting and a sign of the times. So in our last few moments, I just want to ask a little bit about how you use in your practice multidisciplinary care or multidisciplinary approach to treating these pediatric MG patients.
Yeah, I think multidisciplinary approach is crucial to management of MG. So in my clinic, I have a physiotherapist, we've got a specialist nurse, and we see the patient together because all of us have different aspects of role to help and support this family and also a psychologist. I think that works better. So, you know, you've got the medication, but actually the medication side effects, who do you contact when you have those? You know, who helps you support with school, college? You know, how do you start doing exercise? Did you stop exercise, but actually continue? You know, what is safe? What is not safe? You know, how should? So I think that team is really important to support a patient and a family through that journey of MG, because the MG doesn't go like this. It has those fluctuations up and down, and suddenly are the fluctuations just normal or are the MG relapse? So you really need to have that team around to support both, I think, as a clinical team to support your own practice, but also to support the patient and family. And I think not just the team there, but, you know, lots of the practice, this thing is, you know, we are MG experts here, but actually lots of our colleagues do not see MG as regularly to have that expertise to manage this. So actually supporting them as well when the patient is, you know, presents to them with symptoms, say actually this is what is needed. So I think that team really helps with that, supporting all around professionals and the patient and family in managing the MG long term.
That's great. It sounds like you have a very robust support system in your practice to take care of these patients, which is so important. So Sitara, it's been wonderful having you here today. I think we've had a really robust conversation about how we're implementing these newer therapeutics, both on the adult and the pediatric side, talking about why there might be some prescribing hesitation on the side of the provider and all the value and benefit that these newer drugs can bring to our patients. And also, we had the opportunity to highlight some of the specific implications in the pediatric population and considerations such as transient neonatal myasthenia gravis, which was very, very great to cover with you. And so I just want to thank you for being here with us. I also want to thank our audience and for joining us for this Advances in GMG Implications for Practice video podcast. And I'd like to encourage the audience to listen to the video podcast series and download the clinician and patient resources on the program website. So thank you, Sitara.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you about this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthplus.com.